weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world. I'm Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I. As promised, our second segment is about climate, and I'm now joined by Illinois State Climatologist Trent Ford at the University of Illinois Prairie Research Institute. Why separate climate and weather? Can you kind of tell us, elaborate on the difference between those two?
Climate is what we expect. Weather is what we get. So, you know, we think about it's right now as we're taping this, it's mid-July. By the time it airs, it's probably going to be August. Either way, it's going to be hot and humid. We expect it to be hot and humid. And the weather that we can get, that's kind of our climate, is the expectation. The weather is we can vary on that quite a bit. So we can get some hot days in July. We can also get some more pleasant days in July. I guess more scientifically, the weather and climate both describe the behavior of the atmosphere. And the weather is on shorter time scales, anywhere from now till maybe 7 to 10 days from now. And so when we think about monitoring or predicting the weather, it's often based in the physics of the atmosphere and the physics of the ocean, the physics of the land. Once we get beyond that time scale from, you know, 2 weeks out to hundreds of years, then we're talking about the climate and we're really studying the physics of the atmosphere, but they're much longer time scales.
Weather short timescales, climate long timescales.
That's right.
30 years after the deadly heat wave in Chicago, record high temperatures are still being broken. Here's a brief montage from 2024.
Oh, 120. Oh, holy
crap. Wait, did we just hit 120?
Oh, no.
Real-time reaction from meteorologists at the National Weather Service Sunday afternoon as Las Vegas officially hit an all-time record high temperature of 120 degrees.
Triple-digit heat indexes now in the forecast as far north as Minnesota and South Dakota. Meanwhile, the Southwest continues to swelter. Phoenix now hitting 110 or higher for 25 straight days. It's taking a toll on everything from air conditioners.
In the last 7 days, we did 63 calls.
To vehicles.
More car repairs with radiators and air conditioning and overheated tires.
The European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service says this summer was the hottest on record worldwide.
Trent, this summer we are seeing higher than average temperatures. What is the difference between this and a heat wave?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we can have above average temperatures, even compared to kind of our normal summertime temperatures, and not necessarily have a heat wave. So there's not necessarily one single definition of a heat wave, but generally speaking, all of the definitions surround this idea of a period of time, often a few days out to maybe a week or more, with excessively high temperatures to cause an impact. So sometimes we use like the days above 90 or 95 or 100 degrees. Of course, that's going to vary regionally depending on how people are impacted or acclimated to the heat. But it's really that really extreme temperature that defines a heat wave more than just above average temperatures.
So how do climate scientists understand how extreme events are changing in the future, especially when it's hard to predict the weather more than 3 or 4 days out?
Yeah, this is a good question. We come up with this a lot when we're talking about climate prediction, which we often think about as like 2 weeks out to maybe a year out. And then we can talk about climate projection, which is what we talk about with climate change, future climate out maybe decades to a century. It is a real challenge. And we use the same kind of physics-based models that are used for weather forecasting, or at least some kind of similar setup. But they're run with a lot of statistics, both in the past as well as for potential future conditions. And then they're initialized, we call them initialization, with all of the data that comes in from what's going on right now and then run out in time. What's really important, I think, about climate prediction or climate projection, either way, looking out in the future for climate, is that we don't really have the precision that we have with weather forecasting. So, for example, we have the next 7 days of temperatures, and the National Weather Service and your app on your phone will give you the exact temperature. Now, it's not going to be right, but it may only vary by a couple of degrees. But people expect that if I tell you it's going to be 90 degrees on day three, that if it's 60 degrees, that's a big problem, right? But when we get out seasons or so, when we say what's the weather going to be like this upcoming winter or something like that, we really can only say with precision about above and below normal temperatures. Just because we're looking out so far, we can have some skill in capturing that, but we really can't get the precision that we can at the weather forecast. So it's all about a little bit of perspective, and that goes back to the answer about weather versus climate.
Is climate change expected to change the frequency and intensity of heat waves?
Yes. So there are certain types of extreme weather events that have sort of a tenuous connection to climate change. Severe storms is one of those where we're starting to understand them more, but it's just a really challenging connection to make. That's not the case for heat waves. Heat waves globally are the frequency, the intensity, the duration are tied to climate change insofar that at pretty much every region on Earth, and certainly here in the Midwest, we see an increase in the frequency, intensity, and duration of extreme heat with a changing climate. So we have seen that in the recent past, the last 50, 70 years, we've seen more heat waves, and it's something that is projected to continue through the end of the 21st century.
And how about more of the human dimension, like urbanization and land use changes? Are these also expected to have an impact on these extreme heat events?
Yeah. So, our guest had mentioned the kind of the urban heat island effect and the role of urbanization and land use. And that definitely has an impact on heat wave. So that urban heat island effect caused by the kind of man-made materials, the steel, the asphalt, the concrete that holds in that extra energy. But also, I think Ken had mentioned the crops that are transpiring that moisture. So the drastic expansion of corn and soybeans across the Midwest also has an impact on our humidity. And that's something that is likely going to continue, which is why a lot of the heat wave kind of mitigation work that's been going in is focused so much on urban areas, because we understand that whatever the kind of background climate is doing, that when it comes to heat waves, the heat is going to be a lot worse in those urban areas.
How far out in advance can meteorologists anticipate heat waves or give a warning?
Yeah, so when we think about forecasting, heat waves, I guess, fortunately, work on much larger timescales. So I'm gonna contrast this with like a heavy precipitation event, especially the kind we get like during the summer, where National Weather Service, our forecasters, can say, okay, generally speaking, the atmosphere is setting up maybe 7 days out for some potential for heavy rain, but we won't be able to tell you where it's at. And even hours out, we can't tell you exactly where it's at. You know, is it going to be in Urbana on the east side or the west side of Champaign? We can see big differences. With heat, we're working on much larger scales, right? It's almost unheard of for the western half of Champaign County to be under a heat wave and the eastern half not to be. So what that means is that the reason for that is the atmospheric drivers of heat waves are also pretty large, you know, states or larger kind of drivers. And what that helps the models be able to pick up on some of the signals that are driving those heat waves and the physics behind them. So what that means is, like I mentioned, we may not be able to get a good heavy rainfall or flood forecast even hours out. We can get a pretty accurate prediction or forecast of extreme heat risk days, in some cases, even a couple of weeks out. And that really helps with communication. But the issue really is that forecasting weather is just half the equation. We also have to properly communicate that weather, because if the forecast is perfect 2 weeks out and nobody does anything and people are dying of heat waves, like Eric had mentioned, then it really doesn't do us much good.
Yeah, exactly. There's a good opportunity with heat waves to communicate, because we have that lead time of sometimes 2 weeks.
Exactly.
Do you have a weather or climate question you want answered by Illinois leading scientists? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141. Again, 217-333-2141. We may answer your question on the next Weather Realness. I'm Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I, joined by Illinois State Climatologist Trent Ford at the University of Illinois Prairie Research Institute. What about average temperatures? How are these expected to change in the future?
Average temperatures, what we've seen over the last 100 years or so in Illinois, is average temperatures have increased in all seasons. I will say, you know, we focused on heat for these segments, but it's actually our winter temperatures that are warming at a far faster rate. So the average winter temperature in Illinois has warmed at 5 times the rate of the summer average temperature over the last 100 years or so. Summers are getting warmer, but that winter change is really something. And that's expected to continue into the future. So even under uncertainty in how much global warming we're going to see, how sensitive our climate is to it, no matter what, we see all projections showing an increase in the average temperature of all seasons across Illinois by mid-century, by 2050, and also by late century.
What is it about the winter season that makes that temperature warming faster? Do we have an answer for that than the summer season?
We have answers. And when a scientist says we have answers, it usually means one of two things. One, we don't really know, but we kind of have guesses. And two, it's way more complex than a simple answer. And I think both are true for winter warming. So kind of disproportionate winter warming. Some people point to things like Arctic amplification, the process by which the very northern latitudes, and to a lesser extent the very southern latitudes of the Earth, the North Pole, the South Pole, are warming at a much faster rate than the rest of the world. There's reasons for that. What that's doing is it's decreasing the temperature gradient, the difference in the temperature between the equator and the poles, which essentially drives a lot of the weather that we have here in the mid latitudes. So that decrease is particularly large in the winter time. And so that change, that disproportionate change in the poles relative to the tropics and the equator, is also affecting how cold we're getting in the wintertime. So real quick, just to nerd out, when we think about seasons and how much they're warming, even if we just look at the winter season, I mentioned winter's warming in Illinois far faster than all the other seasons. If we look at all the temperatures across the winter in Illinois, it's the very coldest days that are actually warming faster than the warmest days. So it's not like here in central Illinois, we're getting a bunch of days in January that are 70 or 80 degrees, but we're getting far fewer days where the temperature is not getting above zero, or where the nighttime low temperature is getting down the minus 15, minus 20 degree range. That's just not happening with as much frequency. And part of that is the fact that that air that makes for those extremely cold conditions in Illinois is coming largely from the poles, from central northern Canada, from Eurasia, and that air is just simply not as cold as it used to be. And that's what's driving a lot of the warming that we see in the wintertime.
Can you say more about the relationship between heat waves and climate change? Can you explain how it might be possible to see more heat waves even though the summers might not warm as much?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And again, there's a little bit of a difference, different dynamics there at play. So I mentioned the summers aren't warming as fast as the winter, but they are warming. And the nights, the summer nighttime temperatures are warming at a faster rate than daytime temperatures are. And part of that is that humidity relationship. I think Ken Kunkel spoke to this a little bit, how humidity is keeping those nighttime temperatures elevated, among other things. And so what we're seeing is when we're talking about heat waves, it's important to remember that we're talking about an extreme event. So even on climate discussions like climate change, we're still talking about weather, extreme weather, which is a result, as we talked about, of the atmospheric physics and the dynamics. So whereas the average temperature of the summer is more of like just statistically representing the summertime and that long-term change. What that means is a lot of the same weather dynamics that are creating heat waves today were the same kind of summer dynamics that were creating heat waves 50, 80, 100 years ago, but they're working off of a higher baseline temperature. And so what that means is that we're able to, as we can imagine, the summer average temperature is a line that's just kind of slowly going up. It's not going up as fast as winter, but it's going up nonetheless. And the weather is just kind of a lot of variability on top of that. It's too bad that nobody can see me waving my hands wildly talking about that. But what that means is that baseline temperature increasing in summer means that when we do get the right dynamics that creates a heat wave, it's going to make a hotter heat wave. And, oh, by the way, warmer air can you're going to have to excuse me here. I'm going to use colloquial terms. Warmer air can hold more water vapor. So what that means is if there's water to evaporate and water to take in, which in the Midwest there almost always is, means hotter air is more humid air. And so what that means is that the same weather system that would have brought us a less extreme heat wave 50, 60 years ago is now bringing us a more extreme, more humid heat wave that can cause more impacts.
You're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate in Illinois. During this segment, we will be answering your questions about weather and climate. With this being our first show, I asked some PhD students and faculty in the Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences Department at the University of Illinois for some questions they typically get from members of the public. If you have a question you'd like answered, leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. You may hear it answered on this segment next week. The first question for today is, why do hurricanes have names and who picks them? Steve, what's your answer for that?
Well, that's a great question. It actually involves a global community of scientists at the World Meteorological Organization that coordinate names that are contributed by different countries to a list of names that's curated for the current year and future years. And so oftentimes you might hear the same name repeated. That's because names get into the hopper of names and they're continued there until there's a major hurricane that does a lot of damage and those names may be retired. Like, for example, there'll never be another Hurricane Katrina, for example. So those answers are rotated through, and each country and each region contribute those names. So some of the names are regional names.
Great. The next question for Trent, how do rainbows form?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. Probably people have experienced, either they've seen it or they've done it actually themselves, of splitting light up with a prism, right? So the light comes into, in its visible form, which is kind of all the colors packed together into the prism, and then it splits it into Roy G. Biv, right? Red through violet. Water droplets, not in gas form, water vapor, but actual droplets of water, liquid form, will do something similar if the light strikes it at the right angle. And so that's essentially what happens, is we get water that is precipitating out of the cloud, meaning it's formed into liquid, it's condensed into liquid, and either the liquid droplets are just not quite heavy enough to fall, or they all are falling, but there's wind that's pushing it back up. Either way, we have those liquid droplets sort of suspended in the air. The light from the sun comes shining through, and many of those little water droplets will split that light into the various colors of the rainbow. So when you think about that, what we need for a rainbow to form is we need clouds, because clouds are made of liquid and solid water. But we need clouds to be kind of thin enough and wispy enough to allow some of that sunlight to come through. And so that's essentially what makes a rainbow.
Okay, great. And then what gives it that distinct shape?
Yeah, so that is essentially the bend of that of the light as it's being split up, and given enough room and a large enough prism, we would see the same thing. The order is actually really interesting. I know you didn't ask me about the order, but I'm going to answer it anyway. Red through violet gives us the wavelength of the light. So light comes in a wave form, at least a lot of people think it does, and so. Red has the longest wavelength. Think about like radio waves, kind of these long waves. And then violet has the shortest wavelength of visible light. And so that's why we see red and then orange and then yellow, then green, then blue, then indigo violet.
Awesome. So another question for you, Trent. Does lightning ever strike twice in the same place?
Yeah, it can. I don't know if anybody ever seen The Great Outdoors, the movie with John Candy, but there's a guy who gets hit by lightning 66 times. So I guess that could happen technically. Just because lightning strikes a place does not mean that it won't strike a place again. And indeed, if you have something like a lightning rod or something like that, or a really tall building with a big old metal antenna, it will likely get struck more than once by lightning.
Mm-hmm. So Steve, in the 2024 movie Twister, some of the characters shoot fireworks into a tornado. Can you shoot a firework into a tornado? Should you? Does it actually work? Can you comment on some of the facts and myths of that movie?
Yeah, this movie was very interesting because they did actually spend a lot of effort to try to make the movie more scientifically realistic compared to the first Twisters. But in that movie, there's several things that are sort of stretching the truth. And I would say, of course, trying to be near a tornado to shoot anything into it is generally a bad idea. First of all, so I would take shelter and follow the guidance of the National Weather Service when a tornado was approaching. But in terms of shooting anything into a tornado, you're not going to be able to stop all of the forces that are involved in that. So despite the fact that we always think that we can control nature, a big storm like that is not going to be affected by any objects or chemicals that we put into it.
Weather Realness is produced by Patricia Bradford, Reginald Hardwick, and me, Maddie Stover. This week's scientists are Dr. Kenneth Kunkel, Principal Research Scholar at North Carolina Institute for Climate Studies, Dr. Eric Kleinberg, Helen Gould Shepherd Professor in Social Science and Director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. Steve Nesbitt is Professor and Head of the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences. Trent Ford is the Illinois State Climatologist and the University of Illinois Prairie Research Institute. Check out this podcast on the Illinois Public Media YouTube channel. Illinois Public Media is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm Maddie Stover. We'll talk with you again next week.